I wish it wouldn't take this long for Israel to learn a lesson. It's unbelievable stubbornness. It blows my mind. In the newsletter that I wrote this past weekend, the ZWTF, I'm talking about the trials of Nebuchadnezzar, of going mad for 7 years. Such was the size of this king's ego that it took 7 years of losing his sanity and eating grass with the cows before he came to his senses. It was like dismantling Mount Rushmore, stone by stone. This guy was Mount Rushmore in his own estimation. He was Roosevelt, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington, all in the same guy. It's just like insufferable ego. And I'm thinking, that is a vessel of dishonor right there. And what it takes to dismantle vessels of dishonor. I mean, 7 years, when you compare it to a lifetime, is not that long. 7 years, if you were to compare it to the Aeonian times, it's just so tiny, a little sliver of time. So it doesn't sound so bad. But when you're amplifying the 7 years, and you're looking at it, and not coincidentally, the 7 years of Nebuchadnezzar's madness corresponds to the last 7 years of Daniel's prophetic program with Israel, when God finally finishes up, brings all this stuff on her in a 7 year period. And that's what it takes for these insufferable egos that the Jews do have. I mean, I'm not being racist. I'm just telling things the way they are. If I'm racist, then Paul is racist in Romans chapter 11. I'm going to dip into that passage today. But we are so blessed to be vessels of honor. Here's why, as I reviewed in the newsletter, is that we all have egos, but because we're vessels of honor, they're manageable. And so we read scripture verses, such as we see passages of Paul where he comes to this realization as Saul that all his attainments as a Pharisee, all his diplomas, were eventually nothing to him in the light of God's grace. And we see pictorially how this man was humbled on the road to Damascus. And we learn from that. We can look over his shoulder and watch these events unfold in Acts chapter 9 and say, that's interesting. Maybe the case of Saul is the case of everyone. And he eventually writes this. And we see passages like, there is no one righteous, no, not one. How much easier is it, tell me, to read Romans chapter 3, there's no one righteous, no, not one, and to simply believe that and let that be your 7 years of dismantling? You, my friends, can enter a program of ego dismantling. Not in 7 years. I feel like this is a infomercial. Ladies and gentlemen, how would you like to have your ego dismantled? Not in 7 years, not in 7 months, not in 7 days, but in 7 minutes. Yes. Call right now. Operators are standing by. And we can dismantle your ego in 7 short minutes, but that's not all. And so it can actually happen in 7 seconds. If you read, there's no one righteous, no, not one, and then you just say, oh, okay, all right, that sounds good. And then that's it. This is why Paul prays constantly for the saints, for us to come to a realization of the truth. And his words, Paul's words, are in his letters, are so powerful that when the Spirit mixes with them, we get 7 years worth of dismantling, 7 years worth of humility in a moment by a realization of what? The truth. And Paul says that the evangel has power. That's Romans chapter 1. The God's grace, I guess it says there, is the power for salvation. So the message of grace is like a hammer that breaks rock. And if the message of grace doesn't do it for you, then I'm afraid the hammer might be coming. And this is the case for Israel. There are several roads to realization. I'm not saying there are several saviors. There aren't. There's one savior, Jesus Christ, and all will eventually come through the door. But there are different techniques God uses to introduce people to the sufficiency of Christ. You can come easy, you can come hard. I recommend coming easy. And vessels of honor, thank God, do come easy. Now, which is not to say that along with the realization, we have to go through things in this life that chop us down. I'm not saying that it comes, that the revelation from reading this powerful testimony comes sold separately, completely from experience, from having to go through things that verify the word. Like, oh yeah, this is a nice word. I read my Bible 15 minutes a day. Sounds like I need to be humble. Sounds like God humbles the proud. Sounds like he disciplines those he loves. And it's theoretical. You close the book and then you go off on your self-sufficient day. But all it takes for the sensitive soul is for somebody to criticize you, or for you to become sick, or for some other distasteful thing to happen, and then bang, that theory is no longer a theory. That no, there's no one righteous. Lest you think there could possibly be a shred of righteousness in you. No, there's not. So, Israel as a nation right now is a vessel of dishonor. But that's not their end state. But before I get to their end state in Romans 11:25, well, it's the whole chapter of Romans 11. Let's look further into their stubbornness. You are forgetting the deity who is travailing with you. I'm still in Deuteronomy chapter 32, sung by the messengers, seven messengers about to pour this last seven calamities on Israel. You are forgetting the deity and seeing as Jehovah and spurning for vexation over his sons and his daughters. See, he's still vexed over his sons and his daughters. That's a good thing. You don't want God ignoring you. So the fact that he's vexed over his sons and daughters is a good thing. Otherwise, you're screwed. His spirit leaves you, you die, and you never raise from the dead. How would you like that? No. When God's spirit leaves, things die. Sure, it's humid here in Florida, sure. But I remind myself that moisture is life. I'm tired of this moisture. I want to have it dry. Okay, well, go to the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37 or 38. Dried up is our expectation. You don't want it dry. Dry equals death. Moisture equals life. And so, it's better to have God with you, even though he's disciplining the heck out of you, than to have him leave. So the fact that he's vexed, that's a good thing. It means he's there. It means he cares. If you're not vexed, then you don't care. And then now we're on verse 29. I got to get better lighting in here to read. And he is saying, I will conceal my face from them. That's a joke. I will conceal my face from them. But if you read this carefully, he's just concealing it from them. It doesn't mean he's leaving them, because he just said, I have vexation over my sons and my daughters. And Paul did this too. Paul was vexed continuously over Israel. And so he walks away from them in a way to go to the nations, but he never completely leaves them. So God is just got done saying he's vexed. Then he says, I'll conceal my face from them. Conceal. Watch. Watch on the laundry cam. You kind of turn it, but it's still there. But he's playing a little game, can I say? He's turning his face to make them feel bad. Jesus did the same thing with the two dudes on the road to Emmaus after his resurrection. As he's appearing to them the day after he's raised from the dead, he's walking along and he's talking to these guys, and he hides himself from them. He changes his countenance so they don't know it's Jesus Christ. Looks like a different person. And then at the end of their conversation, when he's reminding them that this Messiah must be suffering, because they were all like, oh, don't you know about this Jesus who was just here. We thought he would be the Messiah of Israel. Jesus says, what do you mean you thought he would be? And he goes through the scriptures. At the end of that account, Jesus does as though he were going to leave them. In other words, he takes a few steps down the road and says, well, I'm going. And as soon as he does that, their heart is pained. And they say, no, please stay with us. Stay with us for the night. And he does. And man, what fellowship they would have had that night. That would have been one hell of a Bible study. But look what Jesus does. He pretends, he turns his face from them to go down the road. And this draws them out. And this is what God is doing with Israel. Oh, he's there, but he's drawing them out by turning. What does it say here? I conceal my face from them, but his face is still there. I will see what their hereafter is. I will see what their hereafter is. A strange verse. I will see what their... Let me read the next one, see if that one will make any more sense. For a generation that is wayward, are they? Famous passage. Sons with no faithfulness in them. I will see what their hereafter is. Well, God knows what their hereafter is. Maybe it's a good time to go to Romans 11. Let me finish with this paragraph here, starting with verse 21. They make me jealous with that which is no deity. They vex me with their vanities, and I will make them jealous with those who are no people. There it is. I will make them jealous. Oh, you're going to make me jealous, Israel? I'm going to make you jealous with those who are no people, with people you despise, with pigs, with dogs, namely the other nations. With a nation decadent will I vex them. And again, God is still vexing them, so it's not altogether a bad thing. Switch over now, Romans chapter 11. Paul says in verse 10, darkened be their eyes, not to be observing, and their backs bowed together continually. Israel has been bowed continually under the weight of the nations. Israel's not in her rightful place now. The nations are taking the place that Israel is to take. So she's bowed. Darkened is their eyes, not to be observing. Yes, now, verse 11 of Romans 11. I'm saying then, do not they trip, that they should be falling? Paul is admitting that Israel has tripped, but should they be falling? That's the question. Has Israel fallen for the eons, never to get up again? Paul says, may it not be coming to that. But in their offense is salvation to the nations. And we're reading the germ of it in Deuteronomy 32. It's right there. I will be vexing them with those who are no people. And here it is in Romans chapter 11. In their offense, salvation comes to the nations. This is when God concealed his face, turns to the nations many centuries later, obviously through the Apostle Paul, to provoke them to jealousy. So this is a series of dominoes. Israel is the apple of his eye, the pupil of his eye, as it says here. They turn away from him. They stupidly forget that everything they have is owed to him, and so they go to other gods. And he says, oh, well, you're going to go to other gods? Tell you what, I'm going to go to other nations. And he first gives them up to the control of the other nations. Then he brings an evangel to the other nations through Paul. And Paul said that that very evangel is going to eventually provoke them to jealousy. Provoke them to jealousy. Verse 12, Romans 11. Now, if their offense is the world's riches and their discomfiture the nation's riches, how much rather that which fills them? They are destined to be filled. Now, to you I'm saying, Paul says, to the nations, inasmuch as indeed then I am the apostle of the nations, I am glorifying my dispensation. My dispensation, says Paul, is not only bringing you these lavish truths of what you have, but it's also to provide a means by which Israel becomes jealous and eventually comes into an appreciation of her own calling. And he explains that in verse 14, if somehow I should be provoking those of my flesh to jealousy and should be saving some of them. For if they're casting away is the conciliation of the world, what will the taking back be if not life from among the dead? This is Israel's ultimate destiny after this hard stuff has run its course. That is life from among the dead. And that was pictured by the new birth, by Israel being born again. Not one Israelite here and another Israelite over here, but this is a birth of the entire nation. Shall a nation be born again at one time? The answer to that question is an unequivocal yes.